We're at the Santa Fe Institute with Sam Bowles, who's actually a research professor here and director of the Behavioral Sciences Program at the Santa Fe Institute. Also professor of economics at the University of Siena in Italy. So, welcome, but how do you pull that off? I mean, do you spend half the year here? And
I spend about half the time here and half the time in Siena, Italy.
Yeah. You had a paper out recently in Science, which is what I'd like to get to begin with. And the title of it, let me just read this. Did warfare among ancestral hunter-gatherers affect the evolution of human social behaviors? Which is an unusual title for a paper in Science. Would you like to sort of expound on this, gloss on it a bit?
Well, it's the most recent in a series of six papers that I've written trying to unravel the mystery of human altruism. That is, how a species could have become as altruistic as humans are. We are dramatically more altruistic than most other animals. And it's a puzzle because altruism means helping others at a cost to yourself. And natural selection should eliminate that kind of behavior. And the one possible way it could have happened is that people who are altruistic maybe existed in groups with a lot of other people who are altruistic. And that, of course, would have helped each member of that group. And so while the people who were free riding and the people who were not being altruistic in that group would, of course, benefit also by having all of these generous people willing to defend the group and to warn others of danger and share food and so on. Groups like that would be much more likely to survive. And the critical fact in this paper is that prehistory was a very dangerous environment for humans. It wasn't only that we had a very dramatic weather volatility with changes of maybe 8 degrees centigrade operating over just a short time scale of a couple of hundred years, which is more or less four times the kind of temperature change we've seen in the last 1,000 years. That's going on, people are moving around, they're trying to find a way of maintaining their livelihood. And in the process of doing that, they bump into other groups that are trying to do the same thing, and they're competing for what are sometimes dwindling resources. The groups that knew how to cooperate very often survived those crises because they could field a good number of people willing to fight for the group. And that is a possible way that altruism could have become common among humans.
Okay. I think the general perspective, you just picked the proverbial man off the street and said, are we a cooperative, altruistic species? You'd probably get a no, and yeah, we're kind of selfish, really. We're all in looking out for ourselves and so on. Occasionally we help out each other in an emergency and so on and so forth. So the intuition or the immediate story you'd get is not of that. And of course, that's now. It's not necessarily in hunter-gatherer times. We're talking a long time ago. So this is a bit counterintuitive, especially when most of the literature in evolutionary biology in this year of Darwin's 200th anniversary is about selfishness, about it's predicated on the notion of selfish genes and so on and so forth. So to suggest that, first of all, that we are majorly altruistic is, how do you justify that?
Well, you know, most economists and most biologists think that the self-interest axiom is obvious. Economists take it as being a simplifying assumption, and biologists think they have a good evolutionary reason for it. But if people think about their own life, they think about the way in which they care for others, their willingness to help even strangers, their willingness, for example, to volunteer for dangerous duty, either as a fireman or as a person in their armed forces. People do it all the time. We find ourselves in situations where somehow there's some kind of impulse within us which just says, you got to help this person. And I think there's hardly a human being who can't say at one time or the other, we actually took some risks and paid a price, or at least ran the risk of paying a price, to help out somebody who wasn't even part of our family, not even part of our group, and the people we didn't know. So I think that is something which we do. Now, I don't mean to exaggerate it. Self-interest is a very powerful human motive, extremely powerful. The economists are right about that. They're only wrong in excluding the fact that we're actually quite a complex, psychologically complex species, in which we have the possibility of these acts of altruism that are quite common. Now, what's happened in recent years, the last 20 years, is that this debate has been going on more or less between people who have been saying, well, you know, the human nature debate, are we good or bad, and so on. And in the past 20 years, there's been a series of experiments in which, interestingly, it was economists who did these experiments, and there'd be big money on the table. I mean, real dollar bills, and we're talking hundreds of dollar bills in some cases. And then the question is, we have to divide up the money in some way. So I have the experimenter asked me to divide up this thing. And sure enough, a lot of times people divide it 50-50 when they don't have to. Or I'll give you another example. This is an experiment that's been done in probably 50 countries with almost always the same result. The experimenter gives you $10 or $100 or something.
This is the ultimatum game?
It's called the ultimatum game.
Right.
And it's because you make an ultimatum to me. You say, the experimenter says, you can give Sam any amount you want, including zero, but the hitch is that Sam gets to say whether he accepts or not. If he says no, you both get zero. If he accepts the offer, he gets what you gave him. So the experimenter gives you $100 and you've got to make a choice. Well, an economist would say it's obvious. You should offer me $1. $1 is more than no dollar, therefore I'll accept the $1, you go home with 99. It never happens. Never happens. Typically offers are 50-50, or actually the modal offer is 42%, so I'd get 42 and you'd get 58. But the real hooker is this. If you offer me less than 25, I'll say no. And it doesn't matter whether it's 25% of $10 or 25% of $100. If you offer me $20 out of 100, with very high likelihood, I'll say, forget it. Now, what's your interpretation of that? Well, I think the most obvious interpretation is that if you offer me 20 out of 100, I don't feel too good about you. And I'm willing to pay $20 to see you go home with your pockets empty. Now, that's been done over and over and over again, culture after culture. People are wired for justice in that respect. They don't like being treated unfairly. The fact that you would give me more than a dollar is not a big surprise, because you're a smart guy, and you're a little worried about me. So you could offer me something, because you want to make sure I accept. The really interesting thing about these experiments is that people are willing to pay big money so as not to be treated unfairly.
Suppose, I mean, I would suggest, one of the things that we've have suggested, in fact, is that reputation plays a huge effect. There's reputation effects here that we build representational networks which sort of contain representations of our relationships with people, their relationships, their circles, and so on. Yeah. We have this entire mind landscape of people's places and so on, this shifting all the time. And unless this was an entirely private and never to be spoken about exchange, it's somehow going to get out. Oh, Sam took $25 on that. So in a sense, it would, and the other person would look bad for having offered that little. So do you think there's maybe a reputation effect? Does it work there as well?
I'm sure there are reputation effects that go on, particularly in games in which if you and I are going to repeat the next period, we're going to do it again. Well, the first time out, I would probably refuse anything less than 50 or 45 just to try to shape you up. almost all the experiments I referred to are just a single period. And these are anonymous. I don't know you. You're a number on a screen, and I'm a number on a screen. I really am never going to see you again. Now, is reputation at work in that environment? Well, what we know is this. People distinguish very, very clearly between a one-shot game and a game that's repeated. That is, they play very differently. So it's not that the subjects are confused. They think it's an ongoing thing, and then they just don't take account of the fact that it's a one-shot. Maybe I'd say, to hell with your offer, because I want bragging rights. You know, I had an experiment the other day, and I made the guy go home empty because, and it cost me $25, but, you know, okay, that may go on, but, you know, when you have big money on the table, it's been played for much larger sums than this, you think that it's quite extraordinary that people would be paying that much for bragging rights.
So one of the things that came out of those early studies was, actually comparatively recent, I suppose, was that Homo economicus, this notion of rational, the rational animal taking what anything is an advantage, the $1 would work, doesn't work. It's much more complicated than that.
It is more complicated. The economic man story, the self-interest story, it works beautifully for a lot of things. It probably works pretty well for shopping. And it works pretty well for getting people to do jobs they wouldn't otherwise want to do, unpleasant work and so on. So I'm not suggesting that that economics and economic motivation is irrelevant. But for many, many things that we do in life, there are these other motives. The desire to do a good job for its own sake, the desire to conform to ethical norms just because you're an ethical person, not because somebody may catch you, and so on. I think these are powerful motives among humans. And what, of course, in recent years, these experiments began to really be too consistent and too many to ignore. They've really changed economics. And one of the reasons now why we're revisiting the question of natural selection is because the old biological argument that, well, whatever you say about human nature, there's no other way that humans can be other than self-interested because of the way natural selection works. A number of people, including many biologists, felt the need to go back and revisit that argument because it just seemed that there was too much evidence that human beings are sometimes, many human beings in many circumstances, are other regarding. They care about others. In fact, in these experiments, if you try to identify a fraction of the population in the subject pool of the experiment that are consistently selfish, it's less than half. It's sometimes around a third, sometimes even less. Some people just are unconditionally altruistic. They're nice guys. They turn the other cheek. Some people are reciprocators, like the guy who'll say no to the bad offer. But there really are few people who are consistently selfish the way the economist and the biologist have thought. And what this is taking us back to is, surprisingly, back to Darwin. Because Darwin, the originator of the idea of natural selection, spent quite a few pages on the way in which humans could have developed moral sentiments, the moral facilities that he describes. And the way he described the process working is, he said a tribe that had many people ready to warn each other of danger and help each other in need would survive in competition with other tribes. And thus these moral facilities would be passed through the population. So Darwin had it figured out. After Darwin, of course, many people doubted that it would work. And what I've tried to do is to explore in a series of mathematical models, looking at genetic information, information on group conflict, mortality in warfare, and so on, to see if the numbers added up.
Not all of these studies are just done in psychology labs. I mean, this book here, for example, Moral Sentiments and Material Interests, The Foundations of Cooperation in Economic Life. Many of your colleagues here, well-known people, Herbert Gintis, Rob Boyd, Ernst Fehr, and so on. My memory is that you had a whole group of people studying different societies. Was it about 15 societies?
Yes.
15 different cultures?
We did these experimental games, the Ultimatum Game and others, in 15 small-scale societies in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And we did this because we wanted to know, we know that it works in the lab that way, but how does it work in the field? And so we started doing experiments with warehouse workers and truck drivers and so on, but we were particularly interested in the following question. The experiments in labs around the world, whether it was Beijing or Zurich or Pittsburgh, Tel Aviv, they were very, very similar. I mean, remarkably similar responses. And we thought that was strange because we thought that, you know, cultures probably differed and there should be differences in how people behaved. And so we thought, let's see if we can get subject pools that are really different. Well, the first thing we knew is, well, they couldn't all be students then, because students' lives and expectations and concerns may be rather similar, whether it's Beijing or Pittsburgh. And then we tried to think of how could we get the most heterogeneous subject pool possible. And so we decided to try to set aside the things which have homogenized the world in the last 500 years, and that is primarily markets and governments, states, which have a very similar structure around the world. So we went to small-scale societies which have a minimal engagement in markets and in which states are powerless or virtually don't exist. So we went to hunter-gatherer societies and very small horticultural societies, primitive agriculture, herding societies. We had to modify the games because they were being played with illiterate people. In some cases, we couldn't play for money because they didn't recognize its use. So we modified the games. What we found is we had two big facts. We didn't find economic men, not even in the Amazon and not even in the jungle in Africa. What we found was very consistent results that we had a lot of this very different kind of non-selfish behavior, but we were also gratified to find that the societies really did differ. In some cases, for example, you had very generous offers and no rejections. Well, perhaps that wasn't surprising because if the offer is generous, why reject? In other cases, you had a tremendous amount of people rejecting unfair offers, much more than in Pittsburgh or the other place, Zurich and the other places. So we found a rich variety of the results, and we found these results seemed to correspond very much to the kind of lives people had. For example, the people who hunt big game, we had some whale hunters in our sample, they're extraordinarily generous. All the time, they divide up something big. To keep it all yourself wouldn't really be okay. It's a whale. It's a rather large animal. And so they have a whole culture of dividing up things and passing it around. Groups that have very small-scale agriculture on little teeny plots in the Amazon tend to be much more selfish. They don't have a culture of sharing or not on the same scale. So we were able to predict how people would behave in part by the kind of economic circumstances they had. And that was something we were quite happy to do. It was something new in our understanding of where these particular kinds of dispositions might come from.
Obviously, if you do this as a one-shot game or as an iterated thing with where reciprocity can kick in, I assume the results obviously are different because you're then thinking about how your actions are going to impact the person you're playing with next time around and so on, especially in the societies you're talking about there, where you're talking about people acting together to provide group subsistence as well, right?
Yeah, it's obvious that if you know you're going to meet this individual again and again and again, you have self-interested reasons for treating the person correctly. And one of the ways that human societies have organized over the thousands of years, millions of years actually, if you take the hominid line, the ones that have been successful have found ways of cooperating, combining self-interest and these norms of cooperation which go beyond self-interest. But it's obvious that the one-shot situation in some of our games is extremely unnatural because we typically interact with people over a period of time. And in those interactions, some mix of self-interest and altruism is probably at work.
Do you get interested in the what's now being called the neuroeconomics of all of this? In other words, that while these games are being played, some form of these games, people can be in MRI scanners and so on, you can find out what's going on, which parts of their brain light up and so on and so forth.
Yes, I think this is interesting. As far as the work that I do, it's unsurprising that you can identify certain brain regions that are being activated by certain kinds of situations and that it differs whether or not if I'm making a self-interested dollars and cents kind of calculation, that's probably processed in one part of my brain. We have quite a bit of evidence for that. Whereas if I'm angry at you because you cheated me out of some money, I may make a more visceral reaction with perhaps more emotionality involved, and that'll be processed in a different part of my brain. Now, I don't think there's anything particularly surprising about that. I don't think the fact that it's processed in different parts of the brain really adds to the strength of the argument, because the behavior is its own evidence. A bit of neuroscience, it would be extraordinary if this was all being processed in the same way.
But given what we've been talking about, are you surprised, or what is your take on something like the economic meltdown, the Madoff stories, the Wall Street ethic, the quote which apparently he never said, "Greed is good," and so on and so forth. But at least the sentiment was there. How does this fit with the majorly altruistic?
Well, capitalism as a system was designed so as to harness self-interest in the common good. That was Adam Smith's big idea, that the so-called invisible hand is a way of organizing society so that self-interest could be pursued by individuals freely and without a sense of guilt, because it would contribute to the enhancement of the well-being of all, or at least most of all. And the argument is substantially correct in the very, very large. I mean, obviously, capitalism did bring tremendous material wealth to the world. But it's obvious that it's not a complete argument, and it's incomplete in a couple of ways. The first and most obvious one is that often the invisible hand looks more like the invisible foot. It just fails. It fails on things like the environment, because there the pursuit of self-interest is actually endangering the continuation of the human species on Earth. And there are many, many examples of that kind in which we, you know, economics has over the past 100 years perfected its analysis to find areas in which it works and areas in which it doesn't work. Now, one of the things that we should have known before, many economists did know this, is that just as a straight invisible hand argument applied to financial markets doesn't work, it has that in common with the environment. It needs regulations to prevent the kinds of instabilities that have been so costly to the world in the past couple of years. But that's not really news to economics. Now, the other thing is, another important contribution of Adam Smith was not just the invisible hand. He had a book about the moral sentiments, not so well known as the book The Wealth of Nations, but the moral sentiments were these ethical predispositions. As he said, we sometimes desire to help the other for no reason other than the pleasure of seeing the person better off. Now, we're now, with the help of experimental psychology and experimental economics and a bit of introspection and a bit of realism, recognizing that human beings have complex motives. So that, but there's now a big dilemma facing economic policy. If we assume that people are selfish, then we should design policies to motivate their self-interest and to pull it in the right direction. And you know, that sometimes in the case of the environment, financial markets and so on, the invisible hand needs a helping hand. It needs to be guided in some way. And that's all well known. But there's a disturbing possibility, which is that if you design an economy to mobilize self-interest in the common good, it will actually contribute to people being more self-interested. That is, the incentives that are being given to you to act, you know, in your own self-interest, and the fact that from Adam Smith on, people say, well, you know, you may have some misgivings about acting selfishly, but we can assure you that self-interest is okay, because the economists affirm that the invisible hand works and so on. This can have the effect of creating a society of amoral people who think that it's just okay to pursue self-interest. Now, I'm convinced that we're never going to solve the environmental problem. We're never going to have neighborhood amenities. We wouldn't have democracy. We wouldn't have the kind of freedoms we have if we'd had entirely selfish citizens. To think of the political revolutions that have taken place in the last 2 centuries that have brought us the kind of freedoms and democracy we have. Suppose everybody was selfish. Then when people went to demonstrate for equal rights, they'd say, after you, Alphonse, you go and demonstrate, I'm staying home. There was no particular self-interest in being the first person to try to organize a trade union, or the first person to demonstrate in the streets of Leipzig against the communist rule in East Germany. There was no benefit to that. These were people who were doing it because they believed in it. Now, so we have to be concerned about not only the limitations of the invisible hand from an economic standpoint, but the cultural consequences of acting like the invisible hand is enough. Because as David Hume, the philosopher, also was quite a good economist in the 18th century, David Hume says that in designing a constitution to organize a society, we must suppose that every man is a knave and has no other end than his self-interest. And then he said, by his avarice we shall rule him. In other words, harness his shabby motives towards elevated ends. And this was a brilliant idea. This was something like alchemy. Somehow we were going to, just like the medieval alchemist turning soil into gold, we were going to turn these base motives into these valued social outcomes. And then a nasty thought occurs to you. What happens if the Constitution for knaves produces knaves? What happens if not everybody's a knave to begin with? Hume knew certainly that wasn't the case, as did Adam Smith. He knew that there were many situations in which any human being is going to act in a moral and ethical way. Now there's a lot of evidence that if you apply monetary incentives to people, they tend to act less ethically in those situations. If you pay people for some things that are good that you want society to do, they'll do it less. So that's another challenge for us now, thinking about how do you design public policy once you've accepted the fact that we have ethical citizens as well as selfish ones, as well as some in between.
I was talking to Peter Diamandis a few weeks ago, who's the CEO of the XPRIZE, which the thing that goes into space, initially now looking at a lunar landing. They're also looking at XPRIZEs in it, possibly education, possibly health, and so on. And Peter made the point that you get what you incentivize. So that be careful what you incentivize, and if things are going wrong, you have to find out why you are incorrectly incentivizing. So it's really a tough issue, though, to be able to figure out something that is so broadly applicable systemically in mm-hmm. these big issues that it actually works. You talked about, well, so they're playing these ultimatum games. What's the sense of fairness that people get out of that? There's a reward of feeling that one has seen justice done, right?
Yeah.
This takes you to John Rawls, mm-hmm. whose theme is justice as fairness. And you mentioned sustainability and distribution of global resources and so on, the problems we have there now. These are fine philosophical postures and so on, but how does one instantiate something like justice as fairness? As you know, there's even a debate about whether that's a good premise to begin with. Where do you come into the debate on these things?
Well, I think the questions of... First, I don't think there's a whole lot of disagreement about justice. That may surprise you. People think it's a hotly debated topic and so on. I think that the vast majority of human beings have some sense of justice. And when people say people should not be treated unfairly, that usually falls out into, well, things that should be irrelevant should be set aside. And usually that includes things like, well, the race of the person shouldn't matter, and other things shouldn't matter, like their sex and so on. Now, of course, we're going to argue about the details. But I think we have evolved with a sense that justice is very important and that... it's something on which we'll never agree exactly. But after all, modern states implement a particular kind of justice. It's actually quite common across many countries. We tend to tax rich people more than poor people. We tend to distribute some things to people who are needy. We try to avoid situations in which people are blocked from opportunities because of something about their birth. These are not controversial things. People support them overwhelmingly in polls.
But one of the devices, the thought devices, if you like, that Rawls used, was to say that if you're going to set up a system, it should be done as if you're operating behind a veil of ignorance. In other words, you don't know where you are going to be in the receiving line, mm-hmm. essentially. So therefore, plan as if you were at the receiving end and be as generous as you would be to anybody else. Is that roughly the picture?
I think the veil of ignorance is a terrific idea. And I've often tried it on my students and so on, because it means that whatever self-interest you have already accumulated through your experiences, you try to set it aside and say, well, I don't know where I'll be. So, for example, I often ask my colleagues, suppose you will be born into one of the following five countries, UK, US, Sweden, Italy, Japan. And the only thing I won't tell you is I won't tell you what sex you'll be, and I won't tell you where you'll be in the income distribution. So take your chances. Where would you go? Where would you choose to be parachuted into, assuming you would be linguistically competent when you went there? Well, it's a very interesting question, and it really brings things to the fore about what it is that you value and so on. But Rawls went one step further. Rawls thought that behind this veil of ignorance, a person would rationally choose to have a society in which the poor people were the best off as possible. So the main thing in Rawls' notion of justice as fairness was that the poorest people should be as rich as possible. Mm. And beyond that, it didn't matter very much. Now, I don't think most people who would answer the hypothetical question that I ask, a lot of people would definitely say Sweden, but that's not only because the poor are rich in Sweden, it's because the middle class is rich in Sweden, and also other nice things about Swedish culture and so on. But I think that the Rawls was, I mean, he's said to be a radical egalitarian, and that's right. But this cutoff, whereby the only thing you value is the very poorest, I think has always been poorly motivated. Because I care about the next of the poorest and the other people, and I also care about the rich being well off. I don't, you know, I don't think that has as big a claim as for the poor. But why one should disvalue people who are not absolutely poor is, I think, a mistake, often lost in the discussion. Not lost to Rawls, who was very acutely aware of this, is that most people want to know why someone is poor. They're deeply offended if they're poor because their parent was poor, or because they're black, or because they have some disability. That's not okay. People feel very differently about people being poor because they're a surfer, or they, in some sense, made a choice to be poor. Now, these are complicated issues. Maybe surfers should have second chances. Maybe we should be compassionate about people who make mistakes. But the idea somehow that what really matters is just how poor they are and not why they're poor is important. Now, for example, I mean, if you ask many Americans, they'll say, well, the welfare state in America is really not on European standards in terms of generosity or effectiveness in delivery of services. And the reason is the American voter is selfish. I disagree entirely. I don't think the American voter is selfish. I think the American voter, and we know this from all these experiments and public opinion polls too, the American voter is actually quite generous. If you ask people in the United States, do you think you should help the poor more, even if it means you have to pay higher taxes? Right across the income distribution, including people who have relatively high incomes, very high incomes, answer yes. As long as those are among the people who, in a different part of the survey, said, when asked, what does it take to get ahead in America? And the ones who said, being white is important, having rich parents is important, being well connected is important, they'll support helping the poor. Because I think the poor are probably poor because of reasons of race or bad luck in the parental raffle, if you want to call it that. And the people who say that hard work is what's important in getting ahead in America, they don't want to help the poor. They think the poor are poor because they didn't work hard. And that's even true of poor people in these polls. The poor people who think that being poor and being hardworking depends on hard work, they don't support the welfare state. So these are ethical people. Now, you may disagree with them about the facts, about poverty and hard work and so on. But these are not selfish people saying, I just want to line my pocket, I don't want to pay taxes for the poor. I think that the important thing about the American voter and the welfare state is many American voters do not oppose it because they're selfish. They oppose it because they're offended.
Your colleague, Herbert Gintis, another emeritus professor of economics from UMass Amherst, with you. You were both asked by Martin Luther King Jr. to write background papers for the 1968 Poor People's March. I'm thinking about this because we've just been talking about the veil of ignorance, being black in America, the poverty and so on. And 41 years later, we have a black president.
Well, it's extraordinary. I never thought we'd
African American president. So, I mean, so how did you get into this, and what's your take on the...
Well,
the change.
I'd have to thank Dr. King for saving me from a course that I was almost certainly going to take. I was then teaching at Harvard. I was successful enough, but I was very unhappy with what I was doing. I was essentially bored, one even could say alienated. And I had a lot of values about society and equality and justice. I was very concerned about the poor countries. I'd lived in Africa and India for a long time in my life. And I'd gone into economics because of that. I'd found economics did not address these questions at all. So I was finding a tension between my own ethical values and the intellectual expertise that I'd developed as a PhD and as a professor. And when King asked me, and Gintis and some others, would we write some memos on this, I immediately recognized that King's questions were all about economics. And I then had this incredibly elated feeling, well, this is the time that you can actually take all that economics expertise that you've built up, and you can apply it to something you care about. And it's not going to get published in the American Economic Review, but it's even better. It'll get read by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That's a little better than the AER in my estimation. And so we formed a group, and it was one of the best seminars I ever had. We got to work on these memos. I remember we met again and again and again and criticizing the memos. We had to do it very quickly. And it was, and from that time, I was off and running. I decided, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do economics like that. And of course, I recently have evolved into doing biology and evolutionary modeling and so on. But it just gave me the jump start that I needed to say, you can do the economics whatever you want, call it whatever you want, define it as it is, let your own values, let Martin Luther King, let the world's events help you decide what the interesting questions are. I wish I could thank him.
Well, now we have a president who says he wants to restore science to its rightful place, so perhaps that's another good sign.
Yeah, tremendously good sign.
I mentioned your colleague, Herb Gintis. You're working on a book with him at this point, right?
We are. The title of the book is A Cooperative Species. And in case you're wondering, that's us. People have sometimes...
You're determined to convince us, right?
Oh, I don't think I'll have any difficulty because I think the evidence, both through just observation and also experiments... The observation that we are cooperative, more cooperative than almost all other animals except for the social insects, is just overwhelming. I mean, the bar of comparison isn't very high. I mean, most other animals don't cooperate very much. So we are a distinctly cooperative species. And the book is dedicated to figuring out how this possibly could have happened. Until recently, game theorists and biologists and others have set themselves the task of explaining why we see so much cooperation among humans despite the fact that we're selfish. So a lot of clever arguments have been put together about repeated games and reputation and signaling and so on. And the whole idea is to reconcile the empirical observation that we are a cooperative species with the assumption, and that's all it is, that we're unremittingly selfish. And a lot of clever models have been put together. I think the models don't explain what's characteristic about human cooperation. Namely, we do it with large numbers of people and with strangers. The models can't explain that. We do it even in situations in which we're not going to have a reputation effect. I think the models have failed, but the good news for science is that we have a different question, which is we observe this human cooperation. And we also observe that people are actually care a lot about each other. And so then explaining the cooperation is kind of a no-brainer because obviously people who care about each other are going to cooperate. And you think you're ready to go home. And then the next question comes up, which is, oh, by the way, how could we ever have become such a species that we cared about each other? Because natural selection should have eliminated those of us who cared that much because we'd sacrifice our food or we'd sacrifice our risk and so on. So the book is mostly dedicated to not trying to find clever reasons why a selfish people could cooperate despite being selfish, but rather explaining how it is that a species, like all other species, which are evolving under the influence of natural selection, could have become an altruistic species, after which cooperation is pretty easy to explain.
And the argument in the paper is part of that argument.
Yes, the argument in the paper is the...
Which is you're compelled to survive, is what you're saying.
There's a nasty side of the argument, which is that warfare may have played a critical role in this process, because among the things which were determining which groups were going to succeed and which groups were going to fail not only environmental challenges and other challenges, but warfare. I mean, the evidence is very strong. I present some in this science paper that mortality rates in warfare among early humans were much, much higher than they were, for example, in the last century in Europe, the so-called Europe's century of total war. So that, you know, we were in prehistory a very, very warlike community of people. And those who survived probably were in groups that had a lot of people who were ready to do exactly what Darwin said, to fight for the group.
Okay, but if I were, I don't know, Richard Dawkins or something sitting here and really hammering away at the notion that a gene selection hypothesis, selfish gene notion, I'd be saying that the only reason that I would be altruistic or a cooperator like this is that I had been, or my ancestors in iterations of over time had preferentially survived those that had an aggressive nature, but nevertheless allowed them to work cooperatively and repel all borders, kill all enemies, and so on and so forth. I mean, are you saying anything different than that?
Well, first, I wish that Richard Dawkins were sitting here because we could have a good discussion about the selfish gene theory. Now, the selfish gene theory is really, there's two parts of the theory. One is very good science, namely that we can sometimes do evolutionary models in which the things which are evolving are the genes, and the replication that matters is gene replication. That's called the gene's eye view of evolution. For many problems, it's the right way to do it. I have sometimes reasoned that way in various models, and I could, all of the group selection models that I've done could be rewritten as a gene's eye view perspective. So there's nothing that in the work which I have done that is contradicted by or contradicts the gene's eye view. The second part is gratuitous. Dawkins in The Selfish Gene said the selfish gene tends to produce selfish behavior. That is, the fact that the genes are, quote, trying to replicate means that the bearer of the genes, the individual human being, will therefore be likely to be selfish. Now that's a non sequitur, because the fact that the genes will, of course, the genes that replicate more will be found in greater plenitude in subsequent generations, is that's just arithmetic. The fact that that can only lead the individuals to be selfish is, of course, contradicted by exactly the argument that I gave about groups competing. So the group competition argument that I developed here, I use individual selection-based models, that it's the individuals who are dying or replicating and they're having more or fewer children and so on. If I did it with genes, I'd get the same result. So there's, I think the key problem is the idea that a gene's eye view commits you to self-interested humans is just false. I mean, that's just a mistake. Now, whether or not does commit you to selfishness or not depends on empirical questions like, for example, are these models of group competition through warfare, through environmental stress and so on, are they likely to have been important enough in human evolution to actually propel the success of individuals or genes which are associated with altruistic behavior? I think the answer to that is yes. And by the way, I think more and more social scientists and biologists are coming around to thinking that, well, yes, indeed, at least for humans and possibly for other animals, this kind of group competition could be a very powerful force. For many, many other animals, not.
I assume that in anthropology departments, and you would know better than I, that people, one of the set books that people must be reading as they go through their undergraduate classes is Napoleon Chagnon's book on the Yanomami, which clearly is making the case that, you know, fierceness is good, if you like. And that the fiercer Unukai leave more offspring and so on and so forth. Is that still the case? Is that in debate again, or has that been refuted? How does that fit into the picture that you're talking about?
Well, there are a number of findings. There are some that support Chagnon. There are some that don't. There's obviously a problem, which is if you are very, very fierce, you're also likely to be very dead. And so the you know, you may have reproductive advantages while you live, but a shorter lifespan and so on. If it's true that the fierce ones also have greater mating possibilities and so on, then it's not at all a problem to explain why, of course, that fierceness towards outsiders could evolve. I think the the important role of warfare in the Amazonian groups was controversial in part because at the time that Chagnon's work came out, many people thought that hunter-gatherer groups, and the Amazonian groups are not hunters and gatherers, they're horticultural groups, they grow domesticated crops. But people thought that these people were peaceful, and there was a certain idealization of our ancestral groups. And I think that's now essentially, everyone accepts the fact that in many groups and many periods of time during the last 40 or 50,000 years, there were periods of intensive warfare. So the fact that warfare should be an important force is not a big surprise. There are still some puzzles about, and they apply to chimpanzees and they apply to other species as well, which is when you see people cooperating, for example, when chimps do a patrol a boundary of a group, wouldn't it be in the interest of one of the male chimps to stay home? And just because they encounter other groups and they sometimes have injuries, but seldom, because they usually don't encounter a group unless they outnumber a single individual. But staying home has advantages for reproduction, obviously, because all the ladies are at home. And so there are costs to participating in this defensive activity. And of course, it's kind of puzzling, the same reason that why do individual members of a hunter-gatherer group, when they're going off to ambush or to raid in some other area, why doesn't the guy say, good luck, guys, I'm staying home? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the answer is any group that had too many guys saying, good luck, I'm staying home, would probably lose. And so whatever those genes are that led the guy to be selfish and not want to go along probably wouldn't be proliferating, at least if warfare was intense enough and lethal enough, as lethal as I demonstrate that it probably was.
Yeah, it's actually all very complicated. You know, I was at a meeting at Arizona State, ASU, the Origins Symposium, a couple of months ago, and talked to Kim Hill there and Polly Wiesner. Kim Hill obviously worked with the Ache, as you know, mm-hmm. Polly Wiesner with Kung. Mm-hmm. And the story is much more subtle than mm-hmm. than some of the general media reports tend to come out. I think that's one. How did you? Let's just pop back for a second. How did you get into this? I mean, what's your family background? Was your parents scientists or?
No, my parents were not only not scientists. They were actually, they referred to intellectuals as eggheads, and that was not a flattering term. And I never thought I would do science. I thought I might do law or I don't know what. I went and, but I did have a question in my mind that is probably important. When I was 11, I was living in India and I was going to school, a very large school of Indian kids. My sisters and I were the only non-Indian kids in the school. And of course, I was very aware that people were very poor. I mean, my fellow students were poor, and but particularly the people living where I was living were very poor. And in school, I noticed that I was pretty average when it came to running and doing math and other things. And I remember one day going home to my mom and saying, you know, I'm not able to do anything really very much better than the average among these kids. And why are Indians so poor then? Because back in Connecticut, where I was from, you know, there was really not that many poor people where we came from, and they were not, you know, the income level was much higher. And I remember pressing her about, well, so what's the big deal? Because they're really just like us. And she struggled with that one for about half an hour or something with me. And I've struggled with that one for the rest of my life, which is how come the economic fortunes of people around the world are so different, given the fact that we really are so similar. Now, the so similar was just impressed on me again and again. Not wanting to become an egghead when I left college, I went to a remote part of Nigeria, and I was a teacher there for 3 years. And that impressed me also with the problems of poor nations and poverty. It also impressed me with the fact that there are lots of different ways to live. I was very interested in anthropology all along, and I did a lot of traveling and a lot of, I guess, kind of, recreational ethnography. When I finally decided that I wanted to study economics, by the way, I wanted to study economics not because I wanted to be a PhD in economics. I decided I wanted to become a teacher because I loved teaching in the classrooms in Nigeria. And so I eventually slipped into being a PhD in economics, and then Martin Luther King came along and said, "Oh, by the way, son, what you've got in your head might actually be useful for some of the things you believe in." I had met him through anti-war activities a few years earlier, anti-Vietnam War activities, and I mean that basically is that gave me my interest in human diversity and also the and equality, and I had learned just by observing people in India, Africa, and so on, that this assumption of self-interest really wasn't very common. I could have observed the same thing in America, as I say. There's plenty of things to look at that would have convinced you that the biologists and economists were at least too simple, if not just wrong.
So how does that, I mean, unless I've inferred this incorrectly, I mean, I'm assuming that you came from a family with a fairly prominent father who was a politician, an ambassador, and so on, so Chester Bowles, right? I mean, that's an environment in which you either take it all on board or just say, I'm going to do something completely different.
I didn't intend to do something different. There's never been a scientist in my family, and I think I deliberately tried to thwart my intellectual development. I insisted on going to a high school in Deep River, Connecticut, that had never sent a single individual to an Ivy League college, despite the fact that there we are, nested right between Harvard, Yale, Brown, etc. I was interested in sports, and I got captivated by thinking and science late in the game. As I say, I became a PhD because I wanted to be a teacher, not because I wanted to be a scientist. And then, of course, once I started on this course, for me, it's been a kid in a candy shop for the last 40 years. I just can't stop.
But there is a kind of a curious circle here in that you are, you're interested in the intersection of science and social policy.
No, I haven't left, the question I asked my mom when I was 11, and I haven't left the elation that I felt when I realized that I could actually do something to provide some of the intellectual background to the Poor People's March.
If you hadn't been gone into economics and sciences and so on, what else is something else you'd have liked to have been?
I have no idea. I was a musician when I was a student, and I toured the Soviet Union doing Russian music for 2 summers, and I loved music. But and I I was fluent in Russian, and I learned a lot that way. And I think I can say that among the happiest times I've ever had is performing music when we really got it right. I was part of a group, and it's just ex more exciting than anything I can imagine. But I was a lousy musician, and I just couldn't. I couldn't. I was very lucky to be. I was a singer. I was singing with a group of people who were much better than me. It was by quite a good stroke of luck that they allowed me to come along.
Russian because you, I mean, did you study Russian or something? Was it just
Yeah, I started off in Russian studies. It was the middle of the Cold War, and it was kind of one of the, there. I was looking for something a little unusual to do, and so Russian studies during the Cold War, kind of oppositional thing to do. And of course, the Russian culture is very interested. And of course, because of that, I got interested in Russian music, and I had this wonderful 3-year experience of immersion in Russian music, and spending a lot of time touring all parts except for Siberia of the Soviet Union, learning a lot about communism with a capital C.
Moral sentiments. You know that the Science Network has been running for some years now, 3 years. A meeting called Beyond Belief, and we've dealt with lots of things: neuroethics, neurolaw. This is your brain on money. This is your brain, including this is your brain on God, because the morality issue is obviously front and center, and brings out these opposing views, which are particularly prevalent in American society, which is the religious and atheistic, new atheistic arguments that are going on. Do you situate yourself anywhere along that line?
No, I don't particularly. I mean, I know one sees very strong ethical commitments right across that spectrum, from the secular morality of many atheistic people to the religiously encoded morality of people who are more religious. I think there is a big difference between people and relatively how individualistic as opposed to other-oriented they are. It may bear some, I think, quite probably weak relationship to their religiosity. I mean, what we know is that as people become more educated, they tend to become more selfish. In terms of that is, when we do experiments with people who are not in universities, but just normal people in the street, we tend to find that people are a little more generous, which wouldn't be surprising. Poor people give a larger fraction of their income to charity than rich people do, and they volunteer more too. So,
That's the story of the widow's mite.
yeah. But no, I don't have a real insight on that. And I think the religions are one of the ways in which these moral ideas about helping others and not harming others and so on is quite common across the religions. And it's not surprising that the religions have taught these things because the surviving populations that adopted these religions probably did better than people who had other views, which said, okay, it's okay to rip off your neighbor.
If you, I made you master of the universe now, and knowing what you know now, the papers you've written, the stuff you're working on, the book you're working on with Sam, do you have any policy ideas that you would have loved to implement if you were in a position to do so? Now knowing what you know about human nature, how do you think you could best incentivize us to produce a better society?
Well, the first thing I would do is I would put a tax on people who use the word incentivize. And for two reasons. One is,
I owe you $2 so far.
well, the first is that turning nouns into verbs is probably generally a bad idea. And that particular word is offensive because it suggests that in order for people to do things, they have to have the incentive, which usually means some kind of money in hand. I think to go back to Hume, who
Oh, I
thought
thought
that.
I was trying to use professional terminology there, but
That's all
obviously.
right. When I think of, going
Thank
back to
you.
Hume, who said that constitutions should be designed for knaves, he had in mind that there might be a few knaves in the society, therefore we better take account of them. But he got it wrong because while we do have a lot of selfish people, we have a lot of others. And so I think it's fairly obvious that what we need is in thinking about public policy and thinking about incentives, things that are going to make people be aware of the needs of others and act on those things. Of course, things like providing monetary incentive for certain things sometimes work. But the basis for reasoning about this cannot be that we have a homogeneously selfish population, and therefore let's see if we can get them to do right. I think we should say we've got a society of people who mostly want to do right. Under some circumstances, they don't. All of them will be selfish some of the time. And so we have to have a public policy that appeals to these higher values that people have, empowers them, makes them salient, and brings those things to the fore. And I think, leadership at the highest level can do that. That is, by suggesting the kind of stories that one tells about what it means, in our case, to be an American. Presidents differ in this, but there have been some great storytellers as presidents. Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, for example. They see their job as primarily one of enhancing the salience of the values that they think are important. And I think that's an important part of leadership. When you think of leadership, we think of policy making. It's also storytelling. It's also tutelage. Great political leaders know that, and they use it.
What are you optimistic about?
Oh, hell, I'm optimistic about everything. It's very hard not to be optimistic in the United States of America in the year 2009. Because this country has shown that it could do something that almost nobody thought it could do, including me from the perspective of 1968 when Martin Luther King asked me to get on board. I mean, this is it'll take me a long time to be blasé about the fact that this country elected a non-white president. And I'm also optimistic about science. I mean, my own field, economics, has been transformed in recent years, partly by empirical work and partly simply by the advance of mathematics, in which has revealed certain things that we never would have known if we hadn't pushed the envelope as far as it would go. So both in the larger social picture and in the concrete what's going on in the scientific community today, of course, the debates will rage and so on, but they're raging about incredibly interesting stuff. And, we're going to be 10 years from now, we're going to be way down the road, for better or for worse, for my own particular hypotheses. But, things are happening very, very quickly now. And, I mean, it's a great time to be a scientist and an American.
Sam Bowles, thanks very much.
Thank you.